The 13th Hour, written and illustrated by Joshua Blum, read by the author. For dreamers of an impossible dream, who look beyond what is easily seen, may your dreams soar high and fly true, for sometimes, when you try, they find you. And for my brother, who remembers the story from the beginning and saw it through until the end. Dreams are real while they last. Can we say more of life? Havelock Ellis. Copyright 2004. Prologue to Part 1. 15 times 15 is what, class? Asked the teacher at the front of the room. 225, answered 30 mechanical voices. Very good, class. Now 16 times 16. In the far corner sat a boy to which no one ever paid much attention. Some folks spend their whole lives trying to fit into a crowd, but this fellow didn't have to worry, because if you were looking for a face in the crowd, he'd certainly do. He was neither good nor bad-looking in appearance, not a particularly good student, but not a particularly bad one either, and his talents, well, wait, who are we talking about again? That's what his teachers wondered anyway. Whenever they graded his exams or homework, they usually had to puzzle for a while to match a face to the name. His name was Alfred, and at the moment he didn't remember what 16 times 16 was, but he mouthed an imaginary answer in time with his classmates so the teacher wouldn't notice. It wasn't like he was listening anyway. Though he was sitting inside a stuffy classroom, resting his head on his hands, his mind was elsewhere. Outside, the wind blew, whistling as it passed by the half-open window, gently rustling Alfred's hair. A cloud rolled by, shaped like a rider on a horse, a knight perhaps. The next cloud was a dragon, with plumes of smoke coming out of its nostrils, chasing at the knight's heels. With a gust of wind, the knight avoided his fiery doom by spinning around and plunging his spear headlong into the dragon. Alfred looked away, now that the battle was over. The breeze stopped, and the haze returned. All the brains cranking out answers in this cramped classroom couldn't have helped the heat much. It was getting hard to concentrate, even on daydreaming. Usually, Alfred never had to try to daydream. It just sort of happened. Now, his mind couldn't hold a thought. He couldn't envision the stories and places of which he liked to dream. It was all he could do just to hear the droning of the teacher's voice. His head drooped a little, and then it snapped back suddenly. The teacher caught it. A quick glance at her seating chart revealed the boy's elusive name, but he was still a mystery to her. He wasn't a troublemaker. He simply sat quietly and did what he was told without protest or comment. But it was obvious that, though he was here in body, his mind was a million miles away. Like everyone else, she'd never given him much of her time, and up to then, her excuse had been that she had too many other children with more pressing needs. But at that moment, she wondered if she'd been wrong in not trying to give him more attention. It was part of her job, wasn't it? But that part of her training in teaching school consisted of a grand total of about 2 didactic lectures, and she did not know how to begin to reach the boy. "Alfred, you're not falling asleep on us, are you?" she called out, instantly regretting that shaming him was the best she could do. Alfred heard the teacher's voice as if it were at the end of a long corridor, slow, hard to make out, and maybe not altogether there at all. His own reply sounded much the same. No, ma'am. But pretty soon the whole room, the chalkboard, the teacher, the other students, all disappeared, as if enveloped by one of the clouds he had observed just a few minutes ago. Alfred could have sworn that he heard a chime go off next. 1, 2, 3, all the way to 13. Then everything was black, for a time. Then Alfred slowly saw a picture, a shadowy image of a man and a woman. They seemed to be floating in what looked like outer space, though Alfred couldn't tell because he couldn't make out any stars. But the utter blackness reminded him of space. Then the man and woman sat down under what looked like a tree. A tree in space? That couldn't be right, thought Alfred. Am I dreaming? "Yes, you are, Alfred," said the two people, turning toward him. They seem to shimmer against the darkness of their surroundings. Their voices sound like the tinkling of wind chimes, sometimes high, sometimes low. "We are the dream you're about to see," they said. "I don't understand," thought Alfred. "You will," they said. "Just watch, and you'll see," they said. Their voices seemed to sing. "What kind of dream?" "Just a story," said the woman. "You can listen if you wish." "What kind of story?" thought Alfred. "I liked adventures best, especially the ones that have no kissing." "Well, we'll try our best to keep that at a minimum. So would you like to listen?" they asked. "Sure," thought Alfred. "Then let's begin. Follow us," they said, pulling Alfred off to a magical, forgotten land where even dreams are real. Granted, you can't experience Alfred's dream exactly as he did, but you can read about it. The dream that Alfred saw is the story you're about to read. It begins, as many dreams do, with a wish. Part 1. Angels' Voices. Chapter 1. Hope Springs Eternal. Long ago and far away, in a world of castles, wizards, dragons, and fairies, chaos and ignorance prevailed. It was an era of darkness, suffering, and strife. Evil, wickedness, and lawlessness were prime character traits, and nice guys always finished dead last. But it is said that in times of darkness, the faintest light shines brightest, for this dark age was also a time of legends, when brave souls were called upon to rise above the shoulders of their peers and answer to the calling of noble deeds by slaying the forces of evil. Often with nothing more at their disposal but brute strength, blades of crudely forged steel, and if they were lucky, leopard skin underwear. And so it came to pass, a chapter in the history of the world was in the making. "Oh, wow," thought Alfred. "Oh, brother," groaned the woman, who seemed to be flipping through what looked like a ream of papers. She turned to Alfred, seeming to blush. "Excuse us, Alfred. This is our first time doing this." Turning back to the man, she chimed in a low voice. "But that wasn't in the script." "Oh, I know. I improvised. What do you think?" And he began rattling off the barrage of words again. The woman cut him off. "Do you even understand what all that means?" "No, not really, but I always wanted to start something that way." "Well, now you have." The woman's eyes, if they were eyes, seemed to roll around. "Look at him. He's completely deluded. Do you want me to do this part?" "It's all right. It's all right. I'll be serious this time." Turning back to Alfred, he said, "Sorry, Alfred. Got a little carried away there. Let's try that again. This time, I promise to tell it like it was. Geriatrics. That's really what started all of this. People say you should begin at the beginning. Well, this story begins at the end. The end of a man's life, to be exact. During his 81 years, Darien III had spent exactly 60 of them as the reigning despot, monarch, over the realm of Tartek. He married late to a woman named Lura, who eventually bore him a son. Queen Lura was no spring chicken either, and vowed that her first child would also be her last. Being a creatively inclined couple, they named the little bugger Prince Darien IV. Darien IV, aside from featuring rather centrally in this story, was also special for other reasons. In the history of Tartek, no person had ever been crowned at such an early age. Prince Darien IV had only seen 16 summers when his father died of natural causes. All the other blood relatives that could have inherited the throne were too old, too lazy, or too dead. So the crown fell into Prince Darien's inexperienced hands. The royal family was not caught unprepared, however. Though not industrious folk by nature, they'd been preparing for this moment since little Darien's birth. Like I said, geriatrics is the running theme here. But supposedly with age comes wisdom. And if not wisdom, at least apprehension. And if not apprehension, at least a sense of morality. Either way you cut it, the royal family was not blind to the possibility that their sole heir to the throne might inherit it a little sooner than anyone would like. So the first thing they did was what any sensible family would do when faced with such circumstances. They panicked, then pretended it didn't exist with a quick sweep under the carpet. But perhaps the carpet was too thin, or maybe denial just wasn't the way to go, because eventually, after having concluded that there was no way to keep themselves from living any longer, they decided the best they could do was prevent the crown prince from dying any sooner than he had to. Being rational folk, they naturally chose the extremist approach. You might think that as Crown Prince, you'd have it pretty good. To be honest, I haven't the faintest idea, having never been one. But rumor has it that young Prince Darian didn't just lead a sheltered life. He led the life of a near prisoner. He was apparently drilled night and day in all the necessary skills to be king, but was isolated from any children his age. There weren't any of royal lineage in the castle to begin with, and even if there had been, his parents lived in mortal fear of his falling victim to one of childhood's many mishaps, which children are prone from time to time. The most logical way to avoid any such events, they reasoned, was to completely eliminate contact with other children, who tended to have things like measles, expensive toys, and other negative influences. It is often told that just before Darian made it to 6, his father asked him what he'd like to have for his birthday. The young Darian apparently looked up to his father and said very solemnly, "If it pleases you, father, for my birthday, I would like you to increase city taxes by 10%. And if it's not too much trouble, can I come with you to the public executions tomorrow?" "Why, of course, no trouble at all. Why, what a good boy you've become," exclaimed the elderly monarch, patting the boy's head and suddenly feeling generous, decided to increase the yearly salaries of his son's tutors by an extra copper. So from this crucible of childhood emerged a ready ruler. He was reared a king, and when the time came, he was the king. That's the silver lining, anyway. Herein lies the rub. Darian IV had been forged with purpose, the single-minded pursuit of preparing for life as king. Every day of his life had been a penny deposited in the bank of preparation, and now he was king. The goal had been achieved, the hard work done, the years of sacrifice the child had lost. Now was the time to kick back, make up for lost time, and enjoy the fruits of labor, namely, other people's labor. And what about running the kingdom, you might ask? Yes, that. I do get asked that a lot. And well, I've come to realize that actually being king is so much easier than preparing to be king. Yes. The way that sounds has a rather nice ring to it, don't you think? I think I'll have it engraved. You might be tempted to pass off Darian IV as just another harmless burnout, but no one who wields a king's power can be considered harmless. Yes, Darian had a dark side that he initially hid well. His childhood had given him tremendous focus, and even though he no longer felt like employing it for its intended purpose, he did channel his energies toward other pursuits. You may recall that this story begins with a wish born of fear. For Darian was afraid of growing old, a fear that eventually turned into an obsession. If it weren't for his obsession, I wouldn't be telling you this story. What caused King Darian IV's grand obsession? No one really knows for sure, but I'd guess it had something to do with all the time he had in his hands as a burned-out king. And it probably had something to do with his past. From the moment King Darian IV was born, he was surrounded by death. Queen Lura was 58 years old when she had him. Don't ask how. Nobody else in the kingdom believed it either, especially his father, Darian III, who was 65 at the time. "Why, I'm too old to be a father," he shouted when he found out that his wife was pregnant. He had a heart attack shortly after, though few had the courage to admit it out loud. Many in his kingdom wished he would have perished then, as he was more considered the king of all things stingy, prejudiced, and cruel than king of an actual country. However, he recovered and lived long enough to instill some of those fine characteristics in his son. As Darian IV grew, his family died off little by little. His relatives first, his father next, and then finally his mother. He watched them grow old every year until they could no longer get out of bed, and just like that, they faded away into dementia or the next life. And so that's the way it was for young Darian. Surrounded by people 5 or 6 decades older, he was the only youthful spirit in the whole castle. He watched, helpless, as time etched away at his parents and relatives, and they grew a little weaker each year, a little slower with each step, and a little more forgetful with each passing day. If that's all you thought about for days, even years on end, you'd probably get obsessed too. There was plenty of time for obsessing because the royalty in Tartek did almost nothing. If there were wars, they went off to fight. If there were problems in the realm, they fixed them, sort of. Other than that, they were happy to adopt a quote-unquote gentleman's attitude toward life and work. So, of course, the king and queen of Tartek did not concern themselves with something as trivial as cooking, cleaning, or the raising of their son. There were no wars, and few problems that felt like settling. So the royalty, having nothing to do, had nothing to live for. And having nothing to live for is a sure way to grow old fast. However, I'm getting ahead of myself. There were a good many years when Darian was a comparatively normal member of the aristocracy. So let's skip to when Darian was in his late 40s. Up until then, he led a peaceful life, spent muddling through each day. He was not yet, at this point, obsessed with his own demise. He was occasionally afraid of it, as we all tend to be from time to time, when thoughts of our own mortality creep out in rare moments of loneliness, sadness, or stormy weather. But on the whole, we managed to get by, and so it was for Darian, who had the added distinction of a sovereign's hedonism. However, one morning he awoke, looked in the mirror, and combed his hair. It was then that he noticed something strange under his eyes. Astonished, he stepped back. No, they can't be. Yes, they are, he shouted, as he noticed a few wrinkles on his face. We all come to grips with our mortality in different ways. It just so happens that this is how it happened for Darian. I'm getting old. What have I accomplished with my life so far? He wondered in despair. He'd fitted away nearly half his life, all for what? To make up for his annoyance over his lack of a normal childhood. He ran straight to the Royal Library to look for answers. There, he managed to find a book called I'm Not Old, and Neither Are You, which espoused a philosophy that became his new mantra. You can be young again, if only you refuse to accept it, stated the book. So for the second time in his life, he vowed to make up for lost time. He did exactly the opposite of what he'd done before. Being his parents' son, he naturally chose the extremis route. Everything he did now was with a fierce, single-minded passion. Not love for what he was doing, passion at having done. Once, on a ride, a companion remarked on his apparent passion for riding horses. He was reputed to have said, Frankly, boy, I couldn't give up two or three rat's rears about riding. But it is something, and I must always be doing something these days. It was by doing that he managed to keep his mind off dying. Time was short. He hunted every day without caring whether he caught anything. It was the hunt that mattered. He pored over the annals of history that were kept in the castle library without really caring what he read. It was the process of reading that mattered. He even tried his hand at ruling his kingdom and mucked that up so bad he had to hand the reins back to his advisors. But he kept himself busy with plenty of other things. In fact, he now did or tried to do everything that his parents hated. But really, he hated it all more than they did. He was by nature a slacking man, like the rest of his line. But an obsessed man bears the cross of an ever-present whip behind him, and he was compelled to do everything he possibly could to distract his mind. He was a strange fellow, from an even weirder family, and I don't think I have really done them justice here. 10 hectic years passed. Darian's copy of I Am Not Old and Neither Are You grew dog-eared and ragged. Then, one day, just like before, he awoke to find a few strands of white hair resting on his pillow. He ran screaming out of his bedroom and into the quarters of his wizards, the men he consulted in times of great need. Right now was one of those times. The wizards were the only ones who were considered the king's equals. So right now, they didn't even bother to get out of bed. They were quite used to King Darian's little outbursts. Just last week, he had interrupted a spell that they were performing to ask him to check him over because he thought he might have a brain tumor. It turned out he only had a headache. After the wizards had sent him to bed, they struggled for hours to clean up the mess of a spell they'd been working on. Needless to say, they were in no hurry to go through a similar experience. Finally, with enough fussing, King Darian was able to get William, the oldest and wisest wizard, to look at him. And sure enough, the king had a few patches of white and gray scattered among his field of dark hair. Well, Darian joined the club. More to come. Just look at me. There's nothing I can do for you, said William, 94 years old. Oh, come on, old man, began Darian. What do you call an old, said Wally, 85 years old, punching Darian in the arm and bursting out laughing. Will you guys take this seriously? Yelled Darian, flipping furiously through his copy of I'm Not Old and Neither Are You for a solution. Shit! There's nothing in here on this, yelled Darian as the pages of the book flew out of the cracked binding. The wizards, on the other hand, were having a grand old time, considering this payback for all the times Darian had annoyed them. But I could die, yelled the king, tossing the book in the air. We're all dying, just some of us faster than others. Get used to it. Have a nice day, Wally said, shuffling the king towards the door and trying to close the door. Now wait just a minute here. I'm still the king, and you still have to take orders from me. I want you to find a cure for this aging thing, or whatever it is, right now, the king bellowed. Ha. That is very funny. Hold on while I write that one down, said Wander, 97 years old. Trying to be serious, William took the distraught king by the shoulders and said as clear as he could, Look, I don't know how to make you understand. There is no cure for aging. If we knew of one, don't you think we would have used it on ourselves? After a moment of silence, the king said, I guess you do have a point there, but that doesn't mean a cure doesn't exist somewhere, and I intend to find it, he said, puffing out his chest and jabbing the air above him with his index finger. King Darian ran straight to the castle library, where he stayed for 3 days straight. When he emerged, hungry and exhausted, he carried an ancient scroll. He summoned his wizards. This scroll, he began, tells of a cure for old age, sickness, and death. Eternal life, said the king. I think you should sit down and maybe have something to eat first. Then we'll talk about your children's stories, said Wander. Children's stories? Now see here, started the king, his face turning very red. Sure, there are a gazillion like that. You haven't heard any of them? I'll bet you have. My mother told me one. Let me see if I can remember. Oh, yeah, some guy travels to the four corners of the earth or something like that to find some kind of potion that would allow him to live forever. Something like that. Yeah, yes, that's the one. How did you know that's the one? It is? I mean, we're wizards, remember? Of course we knew. But Darian, it's only a story. Even if it were true, it never tells what the four corners of the earth are. What is a corner of the earth anyway? I think you should just forget about it, said Wander. But look, damn it all. There's a map. There's directions. There's even a letter written by a man who drew the map. A map! Look at the date. Only 100 years ago. Look at the royal notarized seal. I know. I should know. It's not a fake, yelled the king, growing redder and more flustered by the second, though he knew he couldn't argue with the wizards. Things have changed in the last 100 years, you know, said Wally. Yes, but it's my only hope, begged the king, on his knees now, eyes welling up, a ploy which usually had its intended effect. Ah, don't start crying on us. We'll look into it, said William with an exasperated sigh. I knew I could count on you fellas, said the king, jumping up to hug the wizards. Chapter 2. A Promise Kept Elsewhere. Far from King Darian's castle, on the outskirts of his realm, lay a forested region. Deep inside, toward the southern pocket of the woods, there was a small hunting and farming community known as Aquaria. The hunters tracked down and killed the deer, foxes, wolves, and bear that lived in the woods. The farmers cultivated the lands bordering the forest. Each month, a caravan from the castle came to collect taxes. Although the people of Aquaria had little money, they paid the king with a portion of their crops and animal pelts. In January, when the caravan came, one of the king's soldiers got out and nailed a sign to the stump in the center of town where everyone could read it. It said, Attention! All healthy males over the age of 18 are required by decree of the king to serve in the Imperial Army. His Majesty's troops will be coming around each village starting in the spring. Violators will be punished. That night, there was much discussion in the tavern, the local hangout. Most of the men were upset. I really don't see what the king's army has to do with me. Or us, one farmer said. Really, does it ever? What's the king ever done for us? We give him our crops, our pelts, and this is how he repays us? Everyone knows the surest way to die is to enlist in the Imperial Army, a hunter said. Who told you that? Someone asked nervously. Where have you been all these years? Haven't you heard the stories? Don't you know what happens to soldiers in the Imperial Army? The hunter asked. Yeah, you just said they die. But you know how? far from home, alone, stranded in some far-off country with the king, sent them gallivanting off on who knows what. During the reign of that bastard, Darian III, many years ago was the worst, my grandfather told me. Yeah, people would be recruited to go off and defend the realm against dragons or fight wars in some country that's not even on most maps. My grandfather was sent with his regiment, and after 4 months sailing the Sea of Red Mist, they landed in the Isle of Forgotten Caverns to help some ally of the king or something. God damn it, more like a suicide mission, if you ask me. Out of a regiment of 45 men, only 3 returned, one of which was my grandfather. My father told me he was never the same afterwards. He eventually went crazy and took to wandering around, smacking his head against trees. Really, I think that's enough, interrupted a large farmer. We're upset enough as it is. You don't have to scare us, too. Well, I was just trying to tell you the truth. It's about time you faced up to the facts. I've heard these stories, said another farmer. It was back when they were Imperial Rangers, long ago. There was a murmur among the crowd. Weren't they disbanded? Someone asked. They were, but you know those rumors floating about. Nope. Enlighten us. You guys haven't heard those? That the king is thinking of resurrecting them? Oh, yeah. Come on. Those rumors have been going around for years. What about them? How should I know? The point is, maybe that's what this is all about. Which is even crazier. There's always a bit of truth to rumors, you know. You sound paranoid, if you ask me. Whatever. Bottom line, you're joining the Imperial Army is like signing your life away, and I, for one, won't go, the rumor believer retorted. All right. Settle down, boys, said the mayor of the village, who had been listening intently but remained silent up to now. He continued, I know that you men are all upset over this. I am, too. But really, we aren't in a position to complain. I remember last year when the raiding tribes from the wild lands down south decided to come up our way. We sent a message to King Darian. Within 2 days, he sent a dispatch of soldiers to fight him off. Without his help, we would have been axed for sure. We're peaceful people, I know, but maybe in these wild times it wouldn't hurt for us to learn how to fight so we could at least defend ourselves. We owe the king our services. When we accepted the defense, you all know we entered into an agreement with him. He wanted 500 pelts in return by the end of the year. You men know it's been a bad year, and I know you've done your best. But now we gotta pay one way or another. Sorry, boys. We're painted into a corner here. There were several sighs from the crowd of men. Then a lot of cursing and finally silence. And who will tend to our crops and hunt while we were gone? Someone finally asked. The woman shall do it. And the children will have to also. There's no other way, said the mayor. But the women do so much as it is. Is there really time? Why, my wife, she's always running around doing chores and things. She's practically a machine, not a woman anymore. As comments flew back and forth, the temperature in the room must have gone up at least 10 degrees just from all the boiling blood. Finally, the mayor gave a shout and everyone shut up. We'll just have to do what we can. Frankly, I can't think of another solution right now because I am tired, my head hurts, and I need another beer, sighed the mayor, the last part more to himself than the crowd. Why don't we just call it a night, boys? It's late. Spring is still far off, one of the farmers said. Echoes of agreement drifted softly throughout the tavern, and most of the men continued to sit in their seats, holding empty tankards, looking depressed. The tavern was mostly quiet, except for the soft murmuring of some newcomers playing cards. An organ began to play in a low, sad tone. I got up from my seat near the back of the room and walked out of the door into the night. There was a thick blanket of snow covering the ground. The moonlight shone brightly overhead, creating shiny pools of light on the slopes. It was crisp, cold, and completely quiet. I trudged through the village square, the only section of the village that had no trees. I looked at the recruitment sign nailed to the stump in the center of the square, recounting the days till my next birthday. Two months, more or less, until I would turn 18 years old. I would have to go too. Sighing to myself, I looked up at the black, cloudless, starry sky, and the full moon shone back at me. There was a misty white halo around its circumference that made it look bigger than it probably really was. I wonder, I thought to myself, if the moon looked the same in different parts of the world. In places like Those men in the tavern had mentioned, the ones with the strange-sounding names. Wild lands, sea of red mists, isle of forgotten caverns. Such strange, wonderful names. It would be something to see those far-off places, just to say you'd been there. As I thought, I continued trudging through the snow, passing all the small thatched houses blanketed with white powder. I could certainly pretend I wasn't old enough. Probably no one would know in the long run, but I really wondered if I really wanted to. Maybe leaving might be for the better. I'd always dreamed of leaving, seeing the world, and having adventures, but somehow in my dreams, it was always someone else doing those things, with me watching in the background. Maybe this was my chance. My steps got a little slower. It had been a long day, and now my head was swimming. I wanted to retain the beautiful images of magic isles and forgotten caverns, but my mind kept getting filled with random thoughts, and I had to give up. I walked toward the door of the building marked Orphanage of Aquaria. I've been an orphan ever since I was about 4 or 5. I can't be sure, since I don't remember my last moments with my parents. Isn't it weird the things your mind chooses to remember? I can't recall much about my parents now except for feelings and images, kind of presence in the recesses of my memories. But one scene is as clear in my mind as if it happened yesterday, perhaps because I often relive it. We were out in the open. We were all running, and it was very crowded. Everyone was screaming. My mother was holding me tightly against her chest, and I could feel her heart beating very fast. Her long hair kept falling in my eyes, and I tried to brush it away, but I never seemed to catch it because every time my hand would reach out, the wind would send it flying away. My father was right next to us, holding a green bag. His other hand was around my mother's shoulders, and I remember he was looking scared. Daddy never looked scared before. I asked my mother, "Mommy, where are we going?" "I don't know, sweetheart," she answered. Her voice sounded scared and soft and far off, like the sound of wind chimes across a crowded room. Then it became very hot all of a sudden. There was a burst of flames from the sky, and my world lit up orange and red. That's all I can remember. Sometimes when I think of that time, I try to remember more, because it always seems like I can, but then it slips away again. Just like the way my mother's hair eluded my grasp on that day so long ago. I pushed open the door. From what I've been able to piece together using scattered memories and information I've gathered over the years, my folks were killed trying to escape from our village far to the north, which was burned by dragons on a rampage. Before they died, my parents gave me to a traveler on the road with a promise that he would take me to safety. I guess he did, but I never saw him or my parents ever again. It was dark inside, and just about everyone was asleep. Everyone else had apparently returned for the night. The older kids were allowed to go out at night, but they had to be in by 10 o'clock. I wasn't sure what time it was because there had been no clock in the tavern. As I made my way down the long corridors, my footsteps sounded off the walls and the smooth, polished stone floor. I walked quietly past the main offices toward the dormitories in the rear of the building and up the stairs to the second floor, where all the older children stayed. At 17, though, I was getting too old for the orphanage, but too old to be adopted. Orphans that weren't adopted normally stayed on until they had a steady job or got married, whichever happened first. I doubted if the latter would ever happen, and my experiences with the former were somewhat sporadic. I did have a job at the moment, working days for various farmers as a hired hand. No one would hire me full-time because times were tough, especially in the winter. Food and pelts, the main form of payment in Aquaria, were scarce during those months, and there really wasn't much to do during the winter anyway except fix broken farm equipment and muck out stables. When I walked in, it was dark except for a column of moonlight coming from the large floor-to-ceiling windows near my bed. It looked like everyone is asleep. The room had 8 beds, 4 on one side, 4 on the other, with an aisle in between leading to the washing rooms in the rear. There was no partition separating the beds, so there wasn't much in the way of privacy. Boys and girls lived in the same rooms because the orphanage didn't have the resources to build separate dormitories. You'd think that would cause problems. It inevitably did, I suppose, but less than you might think, since there weren't that many older kids. There were, however, separate washrooms with cubbies to keep personal toiletries and areas for changing clothes, washing up, doing laundry, and answering nature's call. It was, not surprisingly, difficult to keep these areas clean and odor-free, and the janitorial staff had long since quit, leading to the obligatory washroom duty that we all both detested and appreciated. I walked into the one for boys. My eyes were pretty well accustomed to the dark by now, but I didn't see the bucket of water that had been left near the mirror until I walked into it, splashing some of the water on the floor. Normally, each person had to go down to the well outside to get water for washing up. It was my bucket, the one on the floor, and someone had filled it for me. Aurora. Even though she wasn't on washroom duty this week, yes, it would have been her that filled my bucket. When you've known someone as long as I knew her, that's just what you did. You didn't think of it in terms of favors or as being nice. You thought of it as, well, what you didn't think is just something you did, and I would have done the same for her. When I had finished washing up, I changed into my pajamas and walked back to my bed near the window. From there, through shadows cast by the trees, I could make out the faint outlines of houses. I looked out for a minute, then lay down on the bed. Suddenly, I didn't feel tired anymore. Maybe the water had woken me up. And I stared at the ceiling, then looked over to Aurora's bed next to mine. She rustled her blanket in her sleep. No one really knew where she came from. Yet she had always been there, as long as I could remember. She was told 2 years older than I, making her the oldest in the orphanage. I often think back to our first meeting, the first in a long, intertwined web of events that held our lives. I had been in the orphanage only a few hours, and I couldn't have been more than 5 years old. I couldn't remember how I got there, but I thought my parents must have dropped me off at school like always. Except this wasn't my school. Could it be a different one? I didn't know anybody. Where were all my friends? I couldn't find any of them, so I sat down under a tree. My school wasn't in a forest, so where was I? I'd have to ask my mother when she came to pick me up. All the other children were playing ball or running around chasing each other, but I didn't know any of them, so I sat alone watching a grasshopper jump. My father had once taught me how to catch one. You had to be really quiet and approach it from behind, otherwise it would see you. The first time my father showed me how, he stood behind me, holding the outsides of my hands to guide me. I tried to be quiet, but I couldn't stop giggling. "You won't catch it if you keep laughing," he said in his slow drawl, starting to laugh himself. Now, I did not laugh. I approached the grasshopper from behind, and when the time was right, pounced, catching it right between my hands. I held them close to my chest and peeked inside at the grasshopper. I wanted to save it so I could show my father when I got home. I wanted to leave right away, lest the grasshopper try to escape. I walked around, trying to find the entrance of the strange school, but I couldn't. So I waited and waited, but no bell rang, signaling that it was time to leave or go inside for lessons. It was getting dark, and still there was no sign of my mother or any parents at all. I was getting scared. What was going on? Then a woman came out of the building, clapped her hands, shouted something I couldn't hear, and all the children began to run. Happily, I began to run too, thinking it must be time to go home. But I tripped on a rock and fell. When I hit the ground, I opened my hands, and the grasshopper, which I had guarded carefully for so many hours, was freed. I scrambled up quickly, trying to chase after it, but I couldn't see it in the dark. I started searching in the underbrush when I heard a girl's voice call to me. "Hey, you over there, come on, we'll be late for supper." I didn't know what she was talking about. I ate supper at home. Nobody ate at school, not lunch, certainly not supper. My mother, who had traveled a lot in her youth, always said that people, when he came right down to it, were really the same. I never really understood what she meant, but after a lot of thought, I finally concluded that since people were really the same, they must therefore do the things in the same way. And since everyone did things in the same way, obviously that was my way. Therefore, if I just acted the way I did when I was in my old school, everyone would come to their senses and follow along soon enough, right? "Hey, come on," yelled the girl. "I can't," I said, and continued searching. "Come on, the food's going to be cold. Are you looking for something?" she asked, coming over. I caught a grasshopper and I wanted to take it home and show my father. He taught me how once, but I couldn't stop laughing, and now if I don't find it, he might not believe me. She was quiet then. When she spoke again, the whole tone of her voice had changed. It sounded soft, almost sad in a way. You must be new here. The new ones always say things like that. She interrupted softly, putting a hand on my shoulder. I paid no attention. I was still rummaging through the tall weeds. Yeah, well, I guess, maybe my mother decided to take me to a new school today because I don't recognize anyone here. I guess I'll have to ask her when she comes and gets me, I said. She won't come. You wouldn't be here if she were. Yeah, whatever. Now look out. Don't step there. You might crush him. She won't come, the girl repeated again. She always did before. She won't come anymore. I'm sorry. She said that very quietly, and though I didn't really believe her, there was something about the way she spoke that touched something buried deep inside, like when you brush up against a nearly healed scab and it reopens and begins to bleed anew. What do you mean? I don't understand, I said very softly, suddenly growing cold all over. I was still bent over in the grass, but I was no longer rummaging for the grasshopper. This is an orphanage for kids without parents to take care of them. What? That's impossible. I remember. I stammered, standing up now. When was the last time you saw them? It was just. Then I realized I didn't really remember seeing them that morning. In fact, I couldn't remember how I'd gotten there. There was a big black hole in my memory. I can't remember, I said finally. Come on, she said. I know how we'll find out what happened to them. I followed her, dazed and a little numb, through the forested playground to the big building where the lady had come out a few minutes ago. Everything had seemed so clear then and now. The girl opened the door to the building. It was cool and dark inside. We walked down a long corridor for a while until we came to a lighted room. Inside was the same lady that had called the children in. She was middle-aged, with gray hair and large spectacles that glowed against the firelight. She'd been writing something at a desk when she looked up and saw us. Smiling, she said, "Oh, hello, Aurora. What can I do for you?" The girl moved aside, motioning for me to come to the room. I'd been peeking around the molding in the doorframe, but had not yet entered the room. "Who have you got there?" the woman asked. I walked up to the desk slowly. I was looking at my feet. Why was I here? I just wanted to go home. To a mother's warm embrace, to the spot on the floor, by a fire where a father would tell bedtime stories, to a puppy, to a little red wagon, to a bed in the loft. All of a sudden it seemed like such a long time ago when I had last slept in a bed, and I didn't know why. "Well, you've brought the new boy. Excellent. What's your name, young man?" "Logan," I said finally, still looking at my feet. "Yes, Logan, that's right. Well, we have a few rules here, Logan. One is to look at people when you're talking to them. Next is to stay clean. People out there may call you garbage, but they're less apt to do it if you look decent. So you're going to have to clean up your act, young man. Tuck in that shirt, comb your hair, clean your fingernails. You've been playing in the dirt, I see. We can't be dressing like little ragamuffins in this orphanage, no sir." I continued staring at the ground. "Now, here's a few things I need to give you, since you'll be staying with us for a while. Well, now first things first, you'll need sheets, a blanket, Her chirpy voice went on and on, and she exclaimed, "Well," a few more times, but I stopped listening long before. Suddenly I interrupted, "But I don't want to stay here. I want to go home." She peered at me quizzically, and I stared back as menacingly as possible, which was actually kind of hard because I never really looked at anybody that way before. "But this is your home now, the Aquarian Orphanage. It's really a wonderful place. You'll make lots of new friends, have lots of fun, learn new things. Where's my mom? How come she didn't come to get me here today?" The woman gasped, winced, and put the sheets down on the desk. "Oh, dear, I've always hated this part." She stopped, came over to me, and knelt down, holding my arms, which suddenly felt very small. She looked at me and said with some difficulty, "It's always a little hard at first to accept things as they are. You know." But of course, I didn't know. I gave her a blank expression, and she looked flustered. She sighed, shook her head a little, and bit her lower lip. "Your parents, you really don't know about them?" I quickly shook my head. The woman winced again and took a deep breath before muttering something on her breath that sounded like, "I'm really getting too old for this. Something." I couldn't make out the last word, but it sounded a lot like a word my father liked to use when he was angry. Then she looked at me and began speaking slowly. "We got the word this morning when you were left here. I don't know by whom, but this note was left pinned to your shirt. You were asleep, apparently. Here, I'll read it to you. Please take care of this boy. I was traveling to the Sea of Grass down south and saw this boy's parents lying roadside. From what I can gather, their village far north from here was burned to the ground by dragons. They managed to escape, but not without many wounds. They'd actually made it pretty far, but both of them were dying and begged to be left there to die in peace. They asked me to take their small son to safety. He'd been knocked unconscious, but was still alive. I feel guilty doing this, but I'm no family man. I don't know how to care for children. I wanted to leave the child in a good home, but no family I came across would take him. That's why I left him here as I was passing through. He's lost his parents, and he doesn't need to lose everything else. Please help him. Yours truly." And I can't read the signature. But anyway, she put the letter down and looked at me. "I'm sorry, Logan. I know it hurts, but the best thing to do now is move on. The man who dropped you off left you in good hands." But I can't remember any of that. It can't be true, can it?" I stammered. "Well, we did find you asleep on the doorstep this morning. The note says you were unconscious for a time. As for the other gaps in your memory, well, it's pretty common when something bad happens, like losing one's parents." "You may remember what happened in time, or maybe you will not." The woman sighed and sounded tired. I didn't have the faintest idea what she was talking about. All I knew was that I must have been dreaming, because this wasn't real. I felt my head. There was a dull ache in the back, on the left side. It throbbed harder now. "I still don't believe it," I yelled suddenly. I tried the menacing look again. It worked until I burst into tears. The woman rolled her eyes and muttered, "I see we're going to have trouble with this one." I would come to know better this woman, Mrs. Hortense Brunscombe, in the years to come. Her strengths and her vulnerabilities, the mixture of sternness and anxiety, practicality and warm-hearted concern, and she would become a surrogate mother to me and the other long-term residents of the orphanage. But she never did get better at these difficult introductions and flustered her way through every single one I later observed. Case in point, after seeming to debate a more nuanced approach, she ultimately looked at me, shrugged, and said in an exasperated tone, "Well, young man, the truth hurts, but lying to yourself will hurt more in the long run." She looked like she was going to say more, but didn't, instead choosing to thrust sheets and blankets at me. "Take these. Go upstairs. Make your bed. We'll deal with this later." I didn't have the heart to argue anymore. I took the linens, turned, and started to go. "Now, Aurora, show our friend his new bed. He can have the empty one next to yours if he likes. Thank you for bringing him by. And Logan," she called out as we were leaving, "don't worry about it. You're safe now." But it wasn't very reassuring. "She means well, even though she doesn't know how to say so." "I'm so sorry," Aurora said as we walked down the corridor. "I lost my parents too. I don't even remember them. All the kids here don't have parents." She led me into a room with many beds. "You can have this one if you like," she said, smiling and pointing to an empty bed. "It's next to mine. It'll be nice to have someone to talk to at night. Is that okay with you?" I shrugged. I didn't really care. I didn't care about anything right now. I put the sheets and the blankets down on the bed and sat down. I really wanted to believe that this was all some kind of mistake, or maybe a bad dream, and I'd either wake up and breathe a sigh of relief, or that my mom would come and rescue me out of this mess. That's what would happen in a story. But a little part of me awakened when Aurora said that my parents were never coming back, knew that those things didn't happen to real people. It didn't seem fair, and it made me want to hit the girl standing in front of me, as if giving her a bloody nose would make everything better. It would serve her right for telling me my parents were dead. I had half an urge to do just that, run down the long corridor, out the door, and not stop until when? "Do you want me to bring you some food? I'm going to go down to supper," Aurora said. "Then I'll help you fix up your bed, and we'll get you a washing bucket." I shrugged again, wishing she would just go away. When she didn't, I looked up at her for what was really the first time. A kind, open face looked back at me, and I immediately felt guilty for my anger. The girl was only trying to help. Besides, she was quite a lot bigger than I was, and probably a few years older. Knocking her down wouldn't be so easy. She wore a faded gray sleeveless dress that was tattered and ragged at the bottom, but otherwise clean. Her long, wavy, dusty brown hair was wild-looking and fell over one side of her face. I guess the lady in the office didn't mind if girls didn't comb their hair. Or it was just a hard case, like the lady hinted I would be. What struck me most were her eyes. She had huge gray eyes that appeared soft and gentle, yet seemed to sparkle a little when she turned her head. They felt familiar, perhaps like my mother's eyes had been. Whether I had a mother anymore or not, I suddenly couldn't remember what her eyes looked like. And all at once, I began to cry again. Big, salty tears rolled down my face, and I couldn't stop them. I pulled my knees in, wrapping my arms around them. I wished I had had the bucket Aurora had mentioned. I would have pulled it over my head and spent the rest of the day in there. Instead, all I could do was try to bury my head in my knees. Now I felt ashamed on top of everything else. A teacher in school had once said that little boys weren't supposed to feel pain, weren't supposed to cry, especially in front of girls. "It's okay to cry," Aurora said softly, reading my feelings. She sat down next to me and put her arms around my shoulders, trying to make me feel better. I wanted to tell her to go away, leave me alone, but the words choked in my throat and wouldn't come out. I guess I kind of shrugged her off, which I immediately felt guilty for. Aurora moved to the foot of the bed, stared at the ground, and said nothing for a long time. "I'll be your friend," she said finally. Childhood promises often aren't kept, but every now and then one is, either by chance or by fate. Aurora kept her promise. From that day on, we were the best of friends. I know what you might be thinking, and yes, looking back, I can see that it was unusual for a little girl to befriend a little boy like the way that Aurora befriended me. But all I can say is, I can't explain it. That's just the way it happened.